Hello and welcome to the Cycling Podcast. My name is Lionel Burney and I'm with Daniel Freed this week.
Hi Lionel.
Richard Moore is still away. He'll be back, if not next week, then the week after. His extended trip to the Caribbean. He says it's a working trip, but I'm not convinced of you.
It's more like a test match series. But Lionel, I thought I was going to host today, but it seems we're stuck on you. There we go, straight away, 2 minutes in. Not even 2 minutes in.
Very good. I'm assuming is that a Lionel Richie song?
Of course, yeah.
Well, in this week's episode, we'll look back at the Cobbled Classics, and in particular, Paris-Roubaix, and we'll be tackling some of your questions as we go. Not your questions, Daniel, our listeners' questions.
The Cycling Podcast, interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
So let's start with Paris-Roubaix, a fantastic edition of the race at the weekend. The sun shone, the dust blew, and Nicky Terpstra of Amiga Pharma Quickstep took perhaps a surprise victory, although on our Facebook page, facebook.com/thecyclingpodcast, I was the only one of myself, Daniel and Richard who tipped Terpstra to finish in the top three. Naturally, I didn't put money on it. Daniel, you did.
Yeah, I did. Having missed out with Alexander Kristoff at Milan-San Remo, to be fair, I did back about six riders yesterday. No insider trading here.
So did you come out on top or about even?
No, on balance I didn't. You know, I did think that Omega Pharma Quickstep would redeem themselves after the previous week. We've seen this many times over the years when they've been written off. There's been a lot of hand-wringing after a defeat in the Tour of Flanders, and they've come back the next week and blown everyone away at Paris-Roubaix. And in this case, this year in particular, I felt that they had a team much more suited to Paris-Roubaix, and I felt Boonen was undercooked at the Tour of Flanders. You know, he's had his personal problems with his partner's miscarriage, and I think he missed some racing, missed some training that week. And it was just probably a week behind schedule, and rode better yesterday. Still wasn't the best Boonen we've seen, but that team as a unit were very, very strong yesterday.
Well, the big story really was that the group of riders that headed towards the velodrome in the closing stages of the race was pretty much a who's who of the Cobbled Classic specialists, plus Bradley Wiggins, a Tour de France champion. And Spond on Twitter asks a fairly obvious question, but it's one that perhaps we haven't really seen an answer to. And the question is, it's a group of the best cyclists in the world, and they didn't chase Terpstra when he attacked with 6 kilometres to go. Daniel, why do you think that was?
I mean, I think they just simply didn't have the legs. Boonen's move, I thought, was key in this respect. He went with about 60 kilometres to go. I thought it was a mistake at that point for Belkin not to follow, for Cancellara not to follow, because you know the chase, well, it took them quite a long time to reel Boonen back in, and cost them a lot of energy. And also Giant Shimano spent a lot of energy with Bert De Backer in that break with Boonen, and didn't have a whole lot left in the end to pull for John and Degenkolb and bring him to a sprint. So I think it was just a lack of legs at that point. And obviously Omega Pharma Quickstep had the numerical advantage. They had three riders. And I think there was also some luck involved, or good judgment, in the sense that I wondered what would have happened if, for instance, Bradley Wiggins had been on Terpstra's wheel. He wasn't at that point, but I think there were riders in that group who perhaps would have gone with Terpstra had they been on his wheel when he attacked.
Yeah, I think Terpstra was kind of the joker in Amiga Pharma Quickstep's pack, really. And when he made that move, they still had two cards to play with Boonen in that group, who would have had a decent finish. Whether he'd have beaten Degenkolb and Sagan if they'd been going for the win is debatable. Or even Cancellara, who we saw at Flanders, can pull out a really fast sprint when needed. But they also had Stibar. Amiga Pharma Quickstep had another, you know, serious card to play, and it looked to me like 6 kilometres to go, perfect place for Terpstra to make that first move. And if somebody did react, then if it was somebody like Peter Sagan or Cancellara, then that move goes to the velodrome basically. And if it, you know, if it got reeled back in a more kind of organic way, then they still had Stibar who could go over the top. I think I agree with you there, Daniel, that really the rider who had the kind of the best hand to play of his own was probably Bradley Wiggins, because as a great rouleur, somebody who could have got across to him, you know, Terpstra's not attacking like a Cancellara, where if you let the the gap open and there's daylight, you won't be able to get back to his back wheel. Wiggins could have perhaps made that move. That was the moment to make that decision. And once Terpstra had the gap, why didn't they chase him? Well, simply because there wasn't, as you say, there wasn't anyone with the legs to do so, but also anyone who had, you know, burnt that last match, say Sagan or Cancellara, chasing down at that point, all they're really doing is setting Amiga Pharma up for the counter-attack. And so it becomes not just a question of how tired you are at the end of the race, but whether you want to contribute to, you know, bringing Terpstra back, fine, but just you know, leaving an open goal for one of the other Amiga Pharma riders. You mentioned there Boonen's early attack. You thought that was a mistake. Why did you think it was a mistake at that point?
No, I thought it was a good move.
Oh, a good move. Sorry.
I thought effectively that was the race-winning move. I mean, I know Boonen complained yesterday at the end of the race about people not having worked with him, but you know, eventually there was some kind of agreement. Geraint Thomas worked with him, and they did pull away, and they got about 45 seconds, I think, was the biggest gap they got. But it did take a long time for the teams behind to reel them in. And, you know, just going back to the finale as well, Boonen himself predicted it on our podcast last week. He said that, you know, the attacks, the decisive attack tends to go on the tarmac section. It's when the group, or the front group, tends to relax, and that's exactly what happened. You know, I think there were guys in that front group who were guilty of probably not showboating, but expending too much energy on the cobbled sections and maybe taking their eye off the ball a little bit when they came out of the cobbled sections, and that was where a fair bit of the decisive action did happen, including the winning attack by Terpstra.
Yeah, I thought Boonen's move at that point in the race, with 60-ish kilometres to go, wasn't an attempt to ride to the finish from there. He was kind of almost doing the Terpstra job, yeah. Perhaps. You know, he was the decoy man for Amiga Pharma, and perhaps that indicates that he himself didn't feel confident enough to win the race and be the one to react if, when Sagan or Cancellara made the move at the end.
No, absolutely. And I think credit again to Omega Pharma Quickstep, and credit to Wilfred Peters, the director sportif, who came in for a lot of stick after Flanders and has come in for a fair bit of stick for a couple of years now for, you know, perhaps being too loyal to Tom Boonen and favouring him over other riders who might be in better positions. But yesterday he made the call for Terpstra to attack with 6 kilometres to go, not for Omega Pharma Quickstep to put everything behind Boonen and to try you know, that card, and it eventually came off. So it was good management from him.
Yeah, I think one of the things that perhaps watching on the TV people don't necessarily appreciate is that it is a team game, and that for Amiga Pharma Quickstep, standing on the top step of the podium is what counts. It doesn't necessarily matter to them whether it's Boonen or Stibar or Terpstra, and they played their cards very well. They won the race for their team.
This is the Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
The fans perhaps would have preferred to see, you know, one of the top riders, you know, a Boonen or a Cancellara win it. I saw a couple of comments on Twitter, people saying, great race, but a slightly anticlimactic finish. And I guess that is understandable towards the end of a race where we've seen so many of the biggest names shoulder to shoulder, wheel to wheel, but then the eventual winner is perhaps somebody who, other than me and you, Daniel, didn't expect to be up there on the top step.
Well, yeah, and I think we saw yesterday Terpstra probably wasn't one of the stronger riders on the cobbles, but he has really joined the top tier of classics riders this year. I mean, he's an interesting case, Nicky Terpstra, a real late bloomer, and Terpstra is someone who has found the classics quite late in life as a cyclist in his late 20s. Was always a good time trialist, but mainly just a very strong domestique. And I think there's a lesson in his victory to a lot of other riders who have been reluctant to, you know, try their hand at Paris-Roubaix or other races like the Tour of Flanders. You know, we've heard guys in the past, like Michele Bartoli, said that he came to Paris-Roubaix much too late. He should have started running it only in his early 20s. Luca Paolini said the same thing to me recently. And yet there are still riders. I know there are there are riders in other teams. For instance, Ramunas Navardauskas, I know at Garmin they tear their hair out because he refuses to countenance the idea that he might be an extremely good classics rider. He just has no appetite for it whatsoever. And, you know, who's to say that he won't get to the age of 32, 33, be thrown in there and find that he really enjoys it and is really good on that terrain. Same with Tony Martin at Omega Pharma Quickstep. You know, Rolf Aldag, who's there, the technical director, has been convinced from day one of Tony Martin's career that he would be a fantastic Paris-Roubaix rider, but he just has no interest.
Well, yeah, you mentioned Navardauskas, and obviously he did very well at the Circuit de la Sarthe last week. And yeah, he is the sort of rider who's not just a diesel, is he? He's got that, you know, he can ride at a very high top end. You would, when you look at the Garmin Sharp Classics roster, it is a surprise that a rider of his physique and his style is not on the list. But as you say, there's a mental switch that has to be flicked before a rider will commit fully to Paris-Roubaix. And obviously this year we've seen Bradley Wiggins do exactly that. Martin Shaw on Twitter asked, could you explain Sky's tactics at the end of Paris-Roubaix? Well, they had Geraint Thomas and Bradley Wiggins in that final group. Thomas had done an awful lot of work early on. He was driving over some of the sort of sectors of pavé in the middle section of the race. He reacted when Boonen made that move, got into that group with Boonen, and really there was only the two of them there that were fully committed to that move. He'd done an awful lot of riding, and then when it all came back together again, he was hanging on the back a bit. But he did say afterwards that he tried to sort of put it all out on the line for a potential Wiggins counter-attack, but the counter-attack didn't come. Presumably that was the idea and it just didn't come off, or was it just Wiggins not being in perhaps the ideal position at the moment that Terpstra went?
I mean, Wiggins said that he had good legs in the finale, so he had some regrets, but, you know, I think it probably did come down to energy in the end. You know, to pull out an attack that's going to break a group of that quality, you know, that takes considerable resources at the end of a race. And, you know, I just think on a general point, a lot's been said about Wiggins, and, you know, people have suggested that his performance has been perhaps overhyped. But I think this is really, we talked about late bloomers, and I think this is really something that could give him a sort of definition to the last two or three years of his career. This is something that he's obviously very excited about. He will get motivated for, because we've always known that is the big issue with Wiggins. Can he get motivated for something? When he does, he's one of the most versatile and best athletes in the peloton. So, you know, I think you have to take your hat off to what he did yesterday. And I think the future looks really bright for him as regards the classics.
And his teammate Geraint Thomas has had a good week, a very good week. 8th in the Tour of Flanders, 7th in Paris-Roubaix. You know, he's inching closer and closer to the podium in those races. They do tend to be races that favour experience, favour age, perhaps just, you know, the riders who have more miles on the clock have that endurance that's really bedded in. So maybe his best years are to come in these races. It's interesting, Rod Ellingworth said a little bit earlier in the year in an interview we're about to hear that they felt that Thomas would be better suited to the Tour of Flanders, but I've always thought he would be more of a factor in Paris-Roubaix, simply because of the way that the riding on the cobbles or on the mud sections, we saw a lot of riding on the grass and on the mud sections, you know, it's very sort of high cadence, big gear stuff. It's almost like sort of track riding, isn't it? You're in your biggest gear, just trying to keep the cadence as high as possible, put the pressure on, and we saw that a couple of times when Thomas led over the sections. I thought that he was the most sort of obviously outstanding rider of the race yesterday, simply because of the amount of work he did and the fact that he was still prepared to really go deep in the final sort of 10-15k.
Yeah, I think, I mean, he still rides a little bit like an excitable puppy in the classics. He lacked a little bit of racecraft yesterday. He was extremely active. He didn't ride like someone who was confident that you know, he could just sit on a wheel and you know, place one decisive attack, sort of drop a bomb near the end of the race. He I mean, it was a fantastic performance, full of energy, full of sort of enterprise. And I think that will come. You know, this is his first experience being in contention in the finale of Paris-Roubaix. He's obviously got the physical ability. You know, he's crashed a lot this year, and that's been a problem. That's ruled him out in several of the semi-classics. But I think the future is bright for him. You know, on a slightly less happy note for Sky, Edvald Boasenhagen, although he's done a lot of good work, has really been sort of usurped by Geraint Thomas as the leader of that team for the Classics, and now perhaps Wiggins as well. I mean, I think Boasenhagen's contract's up at the end of the season. It'll be interesting to see what happens with him.
Well, I'm sure somebody would take him. You know, I don't think there's any danger of another team not being interested in him, but it's whether anybody can, you know, conjure him into a leader. You mentioned there about racecraft and kind of... you know, the thing with Boasenhagen that kind of concerns me a little bit is that unless he's kind of pointed in exactly the direction to go and given a specific role, a specific job, he tends to just kind of go missing. He drifts back at the wrong points. We saw it, was it last year or the year before in Amstel Gold, where he's in a fantastic position and just drifted away from the front of the race when you would have thought he would be in contention there. That just, he doesn't seem to have the kind of killer instinct. We have seen it. We saw it when he salvaged Sky's Tour de France in 2010, didn't we? With a sort of medium mountain stage victory, but it's never come together for him in the Classics.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
Continuing the Sky theme for a minute, recently I spoke to Rod Ellingworth, who of course created the British Cycling Academy and kind of created this generation of British riders, of which Geraint Thomas is one. And I asked him about Thomas's early days in the academy and how his career has blossomed in the last 18 months or so.
There was already a pathway for G, and you know, and again, he's one of them who creates that pathway, and a background and his parents, and you know, it was a different sort of background, if you like, for G. And he was one of them guys who actually needed guidance in a completely different way to Cav. You know, Cav was a lot about, we've got to just get fit, just keep riding your bike, but we've got to organise your life around cycling. G was, you know, he was already on his way. Quite an easy one with G, to be honest.
He's a level-headed character, and of course he'd grown up in bike racing already with the Maindy Flyers, you know, a club in Cardiff that's got a real good legacy of track racing particularly.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I've seen various photographs of him and a few of the other lads who've come through, and all as young kids growing up together, and it's quite funny when you see them all. But again, you know, you think about that club background from the Maindy Flyers, you know, they're the reasons why they're good, because their clubs and their, you know, that early years, the clubs were so good and effective, and just putting them in bike races and having a good time, and that's what they did at Maindy Flyers. You know, you know, there was a good group down there, Debbie Wharton very much part of who set that up, you know. And if it wasn't for these people, these kids wouldn't have the opportunity, would they? You know,
even for Geraint, though, although obviously very talented, very young, it wasn't always smooth, because he went to Saunier Duval, I believe, as a stagiaire, and that didn't work out terribly well at all.
He did a day with them, and I don't think he was quite ready for it. You know, and you know, to put him on a dead hilly race, and if it was a flat race. And he had to do a lead out for somebody, they would have been like, wow, this kid's real good. But they put him in a hilly race, and you know, that's the way it goes. But no, I think G, you know, he's had quite a few crashes, had some big smashes, you know, and again, his pathway is just, he's so driven, mentally so strong, that you know, he was just going to make it, wasn't he? Like a lot of them, the academy at that period was giving them a really good base and a real good background, and they did lots and lots of different styles of racing and training. And you know, I think he learned a lot of his race tactics, and as all of them do it in when I was running the academy, they'd learn where their ceiling was, they'd know how much they could give, you know.
He crashed in a pre-world championship training camp in 2005, yeah. Lost his spleen after as a result of that.
Yeah, I mean, that was, you know, it was a pretty big moment for us, that, you know. I remember very well the incident, you know, and it was quite scary when you see somebody laying on the floor. And the thing was with G, if he lays on the floor, he's hurt 100%, or he gets up. You know, there's no joking with G there. No, what's it in French, playing the cinema? You know, he's you know, if he lays on the floor, he's hurt, and you know you've got a problem.
And by 2007, he's riding for Barlow World. British Cycling had a good relationship with Barlow World, but it wasn't necessarily the ideal place for young riders to you know, gain experience because of the type of racing they did. But it did give him the opportunity to ride the Tour de France at a very young age. He was the youngest rider in the 2007 Tour, and arguably, talking about legacy and pathway and all of that, that opportunity may not have come to him that early had the start not been in London.
That's true. I mean, we were pushing, obviously, a lot with Barla World to get what we wanted and to get the race programme for these guys, you know. But again, you know, a lot of people questioned G's involvement in the Tour and was it too early and everything else. But, you know, he learned so much from it and you know, I think just generally gained so much experience from them opportunities. So I don't think we ever had a problem with him doing it and felt quite confident. You know, he'd come out of it okay, you know.
The big breakthrough for Geraint was to be part of that World Championship Team Pursuit squad in Manchester in 2008. I mean, that was like a real breakthrough. The world record at home, whatever, 6 months before the Beijing Olympics. Well, they'd really got it going by then.
The big moment for G was actually 2006 Team Pursuit. I think that was Bordeaux, I think. And what he, if you look, that we lost to the the Aussies, by like hundreds of a second or something. And G had changed last banking. He didn't know it was down to three men. And he was actually just off the back. Now, if G had actually knew it was three and wallop and was stayed, we would have won the Worlds. And that night, G was crying to me on the phone because he was so down. He was so disappointed with himself that he felt, you know, there was a young lad. That was a big moment for G. And that was, it's them moments where you go, wow, this guy has got it.
So recognising the mistake, recognising
and wanting it so bad.
After that, obviously, winning in Beijing, then Geraint found himself in a position for a few years where obviously has some talent for the road, a lot of talent for the road, and people have always said he could do classics or stage racing. I mean, he was being bigged up to take the yellow jersey in the Tour de France, going into the first mountain stage in 2010, wasn't he? You know, other teams were thinking he might get there. He's been in the mix.
People were asking a lot of questions there. I remember Boo Neal saying, "Who the hell is this kid?" You know, to Sean Yates, and because he was in the white jersey, and they didn't know who he was. You know, so he was very much in the mix, and he, you know, I actually think if the Olympics hadn't been in London, I think that quite a few of them would have just committed to the road. But because Olympics was in London, it was such a big opportunity, wasn't it, that they couldn't leave it, you know. So there were in between, but I think that, you know, that's where Team Sky was a massive support for these guys, wasn't it, and a great opportunity for them to develop and you know, and feel comfortable that they were in a pro team with exactly the right programme aiming for the Olympic Games, you know.
I mean, of course, last year in the Tour, he had to crash very early. Fractured his pelvis and really had to dig deep to just get through the race. I mean, you must have seen him at pretty low points in that race.
Well, it was incredible. You know, that was where it just shows you how strong this guy is in his head, isn't it? Because a lot of people wouldn't have bothered. And, you know, we were concerned with the injury and he was like, no, I want to carry on. And, you know, if I can do my bit later on, you know, it's like, wow. And I'll tell you where the team time trial in Nice was horrific. I was driving the second car, you know, they've got to go, haven't they? It's flat out. The team time trial, everybody's scared of the team time trials in that way. It's normally G's forte, isn't it, that, you know? And he started, so he's going out last on the start ramp, but he can't get out saddle, so he has to do a seated start. And then there was like, I think there was like three proper right angle corners, and then you turn the final right and onto the seafront. And he was like, he's a bit scared going into the corners, obviously. He didn't want to fall again. And was like off the wheels as he came out the corners, they were going. And he was just managing just to get on before the next corner. Then he'd just get on. Anyway, and we thought, we'd said to him, when you're ready to go through, put your thumb up. And we thought, you know, maybe 7 or 8 Ks in, once he's settled, he'll thumb up. I swear on my life, he turned the right hander onto the seafront. He was on the back. He nailed it. The minute he got on, he put his thumb up. And it was just like, I was like, I can't actually believe he's doing this. You know?
So he's in the race right from the start, right, because the fear was if he didn't get on the wheel at the start, because of the speed and the shortness of that stage, he could have been eliminated.
Absolutely, yeah. And he was absolutely cacking himself before the start, you know, that he wasn't going to be able to make them accelerations, because that was hurting him big time, you know. And you think about what was happening to him, and it was pretty nasty. So every day he was warming up on the turbo before the start. You know, he felt like once he'd ridden in, it was a little bit of a relief. You know, so
And just lastly then, looking forward at the what he might do in the future, do you think he's decided yet what he's going to do?
I think stage racing is a big one for Gene. I think these are the ones he's got to crack first. You know, he's getting there, he's chipping away. I think Flanders and that will always stay as a goal, and I don't see why that shouldn't stay as a goal. I don't think Roubaix and then the flat cobble classics are the ones, but E3 and Flanders for sure. You know, he's excited about that and 100% go for that. I think he can do well in these 1 week stage race, 10-day stage races, and then it's, we know he can perform well in the Grand Tours. He's shown his time and time again. He's so good, he's so consistent, so reliable. I think it's, can he make that step?
The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboo, and visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.
So that was Rod Ellingworth talking about Geraint Thomas, who was one of the outstanding riders of Paris-Roubaix, not just because of his seventh place finish, but also the work he did in the kind of crucial middle phase of the race. But Daniel, who were the other winners and losers from Paris-Roubaix, and also rolling in a little bit of the Tour of Flanders, because the races do come as a pair, really, don't they?
Yeah, well, I think we talked about Omega Pharma Quickstep and how they'd done generally. I think on the whole, that team's had a good classics, well, excellent classic campaign. Even, you know, if you look at 3 days of Dipana, okay, it's a stage race, but Van Kersbroek winning there. And Terpstra, I think, really, as I said, has joined the top bracket now of classics riders. Hasn't been the most popular rider in the bunch. He had a reputation as a bit of a sort of crash magnet, causes a lot of crashes, is quite loud, quite abrasive in the bunch, also has a reputation for being quite individualistic. He didn't particularly get on with Sylvain Chavanel, and I think he's been freed up by Chavanel leaving Omega Pharma Quickstep, and he's kind of playing the Chavanel role now. So that team is obviously, I think, will be happy on balance. Peter Sagan is an interesting one. On paper, you know, he's drawn a blank Milan San Remo, Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix, and obviously his big objective at the start of this year was to finally break his duck as far as monuments were concerned. I thought he was slightly disappointing in the Tour of Flanders, not on his best day. You know, there's been a bit of talk in the media, and it's particularly in Italy, about Cannondale's new coach Sebastian Weber has sort of introduced more distance training for Sagan to give him more kind of top end speed at the very end of these difficult classics, and that there have been question marks over whether that has worked or not. And Cannondale also were quite doubtful about whether he would do well in Paris-Roubaix, because he'd actually done it twice early in his career and not finished, or not done very well on either occasion, and they were unsure of whether he would be good there yesterday. But he actually rode extremely well, and to the point where, you know, he was launching attacks in the finale.
He certainly did, because I mean he was chasing back on before the Forest of Arenberg. He had some teammates help to get back up there, and then the next thing we knew, he was at the front and, you know, back in the mix of the race. And as you know, if you're not right near the front, the pointy end, when they hit the Forest of Arenberg, it is a bit of a cliche that you can lose the race there, you can't necessarily win it, but it's true. For him coming right from the back and being involved when, you know, the next phase of aggression started, and for the second week in a row finished the race on a teammate's bike, I mean, you know, he's not had all the luck in his favour. And when he was trying to make that move, and he looked back at one point, and I thought maybe he's hoping for somebody of a similar stature to come across, because probably the biggest fear for him would be to find himself in a group with somebody of another level down, who would be much more of a passenger than a willing contributor. In actual fact, that didn't happen either, but he did at least put his face in the wind. He was going off the front of the race, whereas Cancellara's approach appeared to be to kind of come from deep and break through, ride past the various groups that were up there, and perhaps spring his decisive move in the last 10 kilometres. And I mean, that didn't work for him either. But I mean, do you count him as a winner or a loser from Paris-Roubaix? Cancellara,
a loser, but it's difficult to criticise someone who, I think his record now is 12 consecutive podiums in monuments, which is just absolutely extraordinary. And a bit like with Sagan, you have to question whether, with a stronger team, you know, he might have had more gas in the finale there. It's difficult to know without knowing exactly what happened for those individuals in the first 150 kilometres of races, or the first 200 kilometres, you know, how much energy are they expending. My suspicion with Sagan is that He's probably had less help than some of the other contenders in these two races, and that's probably told in the finale. And I think that will change next year when he'll either get reinforcements at what is currently Cannondale, or he'll more likely, I think, move on and have a stronger team.
Well, you mentioned team support, but Cancellara had a fairly notable bit of hindrance from one of his teammates when Hayden Roulston tried to jump up onto the curb or off the curb, whichever way round it was, and caused a crash, which took down Cancellara as well, and they obviously had to get back up to the front there. It was an idiotic move, perhaps, but it's something that only becomes idiotic when the consequences go bad. I mean, you know, we see riders jumping up and off the curb all the time. You were making the point earlier today, Daniel, that the rule about riders avoiding the road and going on the pavements, not necessarily cycle paths in Paris-Roubaix, but certainly riding on the verge. You know, we saw an awful lot of that because the weather had been dry and the grass and mud sections were firm enough for them to ride on. But I mean, Paris-Roubaix is a race where incidents and accidents happen all the way through. So luck plays more than its fair share of a role in this race.
The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboo, and visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.
So, Daniel, you've got your finger on the pulse with the Italians. Great Paris-Roubaix for the Italians this year?
A bit of a rotter. 50th place, the top Italian, of course, Pippo. Who had a pretty rotten campaign. He said he felt good in the Arenberg Forest.
This is Filippo Pozzato, in case people don't know Pippo. You can usually spot him from his tattoos.
His reputation precedes him. Pretty awful is about all you can say. I spoke to our esteemed colleague, Ciro Squagliamiglio, before the Classics, and I said, how's Pippo looking? And he said he'd look even worse than usual, and that proved to be the case. But I must mention Ciro, because he's done absolutely sterling work in the Gazzetta today. Double pay spread, all Ciro's work. He's given marks out of 10 for Paris-Roubaix. I was interested to see that Ciro had only given Sepp van Marck a 5 out of 5. And Ciro thinks that he's gone backwards since last year. I think mainly because last year van Marck was second. But I actually think that...
Sorry, that's 5.5 out of 10, I think, not 5 out of 5. Yeah.
Oh, did I say 5?
Yeah, you said
5
out of 5, yeah. So.
But van Marck, I think, although he hasn't won anything in this Classics campaign, and he hasn't particularly excelled in the semi-classics either, I think he's proven beyond doubt that he is the next big classic star. I think there is no question that he was certainly one of the strongest riders in Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix.
Yeah, he wasn't just one of the strongest, he was one of the most aggressive in Paris-Roubaix, certainly when he made that move. And, you know, he looked like he wanted to get up there and make the race happen, whereas quite a few of the others, you know, seemed content to sit in the wheels and see what developed. And Belkin, it's easy to criticise them because they had, I think at one point they had the same number of riders up there as Amiga Pharma Quickstep, but didn't use them quite as smartly. Although Lars Boom did some sterling work, again, in the kind of the middle phase of the race, and I don't think it was for want of trying for van Marck. He rode extremely well, and for a rider like him, the big difficulty it was that you're in a group with Sagan and John Degenkolb. You know, your mind must immediately be clouded by the thought of, how am I going to beat two sprinters in the velodrome? I'm probably not going to, so what am I going to be able to do? And if you haven't got the legs, your tactical options are reduced down to, you know, almost none, really, in his case.
Yeah, with hindsight it's easy to say, but I felt that their mistake was letting Boonen go away and letting Boonen stay away for that amount of time, with, you know, from about 60 kilometres to go. But yeah, I thought they performed creditably. Van Marck, I think, is riding a little bit, as I said, with Geraint Thomas, he's a little bit impetuous at the moment, and I think he'll get a little bit cooler with age and a bit more confidence in his own ability, and will wait for the key moment. Certainly a B+, I think, for Belkin yesterday, at least, if not at Flanders. A few others, Arnaud Démare, I actually sat down with him at Depana just before Tour of Flanders 10 days ago. And very impressive young man, very impressive ride yesterday in Paris-Roubaix. Wasn't on camera very much, but I think he finished 12th in the end. So that's someone who certainly we're going to look out for in the future in Paris-Roubaix.
Yeah, that's the FDJ rider who British listeners will probably remember won the Ride London event in August in the centre of London. Good sprinter, but clearly, you know, at home on the cobbles as well.
Yeah, and slightly further ahead on the sort of growth curve, similar rider, John Degenkolb, really impressed me yesterday. I honestly didn't think that he was that far advanced this early in his career to finish second in Paris-Roubaix, and it, you know, came very close to winning it, really. So a good, certainly a positive classics campaign for him, despite, you know, having missed out on Milan-San Remo.
And BMC Racing, they had more than their fair share of misfortune. Greg Van Avermaet went down on a corner on the cobbles, and that was more or less his race done. I mean, you could tell from the body language, he didn't spring up, he didn't get straight back on the bike, you know, in double quick time as the group's riding away from him. And I just remember Sean Kelly saying, you know, when you fall in Paris-Roubaix, you get up first, you get back on your bike, you get pedalling, and you don't lie around waiting for the ambulance, was his quote. But he clearly wasn't seriously hurt, but he didn't sort of spring up as if he was going to get back into contention in the race. He'd ridden extremely hard at the Tour of Flanders, and I had kind of thought that he would be up there making the race happen a bit more. But, you know, obviously the crash, it's impossible to say whether he would have or not, but for that crash.
Yeah, and they were a team that really needed to kick on, really needed to show some evidence of improvement this year at the classics, and they did that. They worked a lot in Flanders. Van Avermaet was possibly the strongest rider, or certainly the strongest rider behind Cancellara at Flanders, and yesterday at Paris-Roubaix they worked an awful lot. Even Tor Hushovd, we saw bridging gaps at one point. You know, he hasn't been that prominent in a classic for some time, so I think, you know, we've talked before about Alan Piper coming in there and sort of having a bit of an overhaul of the BMC, their sort of racing ethos, and that's starting to bear fruit. But I think it will be another year. It'll be next year's Spring Classics will be where we really start to see Piper's influence.
The Cycling Podcast, interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
There's a lot of talk at the moment about how cycling can embrace technology and innovation to make it not only more of a televisual spectacle, but also to improve the way the races are run, maybe make them safer, maybe make them more dynamic. But one of the other talking points that's come out of the classics is the idea of having red and yellow cards for riders who cause crashes or behave in some unspeakable way during the races. Daniel, what's your thoughts on that as an idea? I mean, it strikes me that there's already a fairly well-established disciplinary process in cycling when it comes to conduct on the bike, but we don't necessarily see it played out. We certainly don't see a red or yellow card symbol come up on the screen when we're watching. Do we need this?
I think as appealing as the prospect of Mark Cavendish remonstrating with a referee dressed in black hanging out of a sunroof window midway through a race is, I think that it's something that really already happens, but in a less formal way than with red and yellow cards. You know, people have been disqualified over the past few years for dangerous riding. Mark Renshaw is probably the most famous case in the 2011 Tour de France for the headbutt on, I think it was Julian Dean, wasn't it? He was kicked out for that. It does happen. Riders also get warned. They get, you know, something akin to a yellow card. And it tends to happen in a fairly informal way. A commissaire, you know, at a stage race will find a rider, and the next morning at Start Village will say, you know, I saw that, don't do it again, Sonny Jim, or else you'll be off, kind of thing. So red and yellow cards, while they might, you know, they might titillate us slightly, they might give us the viewer more of an insight into that process that's actually occurring anyway, I don't think it's a major issue, and I don't think it's something that necessarily would be a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, what would have been gained from, say, giving Hayden Ralston a red card yesterday for his bunny hop off or on the pavement. You know, he caught the kind of a curb that was at kind of 45 degree angle. So the riders were all across the whole width of the road. He didn't do it on purpose to cause a crash, you know. And if the commissaires had got involved and said, right, you're out of the race now, it would have just given Cancellara one less teammate to get back on. And as you say, I mean, the idea of a referee being on a bike dressed in black is brilliant. You know, by the end of a stage, he'd
with a whistle,
by the end of a stage, he'd be 40 kilometres behind play, unable to see anything. He'd be sort of so far off the pace.
And I guess suspensions for accumulated yellow cards. I think Nasser Buhani would be, he'd be the Mathieu Flamini of the peloton. He'd be suspended every three races, I think.
Well, one or two of our listeners don't like the constant football references.
We have complaints about that.
One or two, yeah. Yeah, that's fine. Don't worry. Yeah, Neil Laurie on Twitter asked about improving cycling for TV and web coverage, cameras mounted on bikes and the camera feed from the team cars. Brian Cookson, the president of the UCI, has already said that they will consider the idea of certain riders being on having cameras on their bikes, which would give a completely different dimension to race coverage. But I have to say, having watched the Tour of Flanders with the cutting to the team cars, I think they had Omega Pharma, they had Belkin and one or two others, it added absolutely nothing to our understanding.
Some people would disagree with that though, Lionel. I mean, I didn't pay too much attention to it, but if I put myself in the position of a director sportif, I wouldn't want it. But from a viewer's point of view, you know, we've seen the team car footage before on, it tends to be a long time after the event. We've seen documentaries, that there was one on the La Française des Jeux, and Marc Madio was certainly very entertaining behind the wheel. I don't have a problem with it from a viewer's perspective. I just don't know why the teams would necessarily want it, particularly if it's live. I don't know whether there's any delay between when it goes out and when it actually is being filmed.
No, I think the idea of having camera footage in the car for use later to kind of piece together the story of the race, like they did Sportster, the Belgian broadcaster, did a few years ago with the Tour of Flanders, but they made it into almost a slapstick thing where the last shot was of the Garmin car shunting somebody, basically crashing into the back of another team car and expletives and what have you. But the Tour of Flanders, it's very hard to hear what people were saying. Unless you understand Flemish, then you're not going to pick up an awful lot anyway. I just do wonder, you know, what we are hoping to get from that. You know, if you mic up a manager on the touchline in a football match, sorry to our two listeners who complain about football references.
Who are they?
I'm not going to name and shame them. They know who they are. And they've probably turned off by now anyway. But if you mic up a manager or a coach in a sport that's happening on a pitch, and you were to hear what they were saying, you might garner some understanding of what's going on. I just wonder whether or not it's adding enough to... It just seemed to me to be a small screen cut into the larger picture, audio that I couldn't really hear very well, and it's not dynamic enough to work on television. I don't think that's going to win over, you know, fans in their tens of thousands.
No, but I think it's worth a try. No, I mean, there's nothing to lose, really. It's not going to turn people off. And you know, if you film, or use Wilfred Peters again as an example, for enough hours, you will get a "Do I not like that" in Flemish eventually. No,
that is very true, actually. Yeah, Wilfred Peters. I was impressed that they managed to find enough time when, you know, he's not eating or drinking in the team car. Dear old Wilfred, he has put on a bit of timber since his racing days.
Job. I mean, just on that, it's a good job that we are in 2014 and not in, for instance, the 1980s. There was a famous former Italian rider who subsequently became a director sportif, Dino Zandigu, one of the great characters in cycling history. His fellow director sportifs always used to, without even looking at the logos on the car, they would know which car Zandigu would in, because empty bottles of wine would be flying out of the car at regular intervals.
Well, that certainly would liven up the TV coverage. But I think some of the other things that occur to me, some of the data that we could, we could use to make the TV pictures better. It always strikes me, we never know how fast they're riding. You know, there's the technology definitely exists to be able to say Nicky Terpstra is riding at 53 kilometres an hour, and the Chase Group are riding at 52 kilometres an hour. Therefore, the gap's going to go out. That would add to our understanding of how the race is playing out. Whether or not riders would necessarily want their heart rate data on there, displayed on the screen, you know, because other teams would be able to, you know, they'd be able to guess whether or not a rider's on the limit. You know, just would give little clues to the opposition that perhaps wouldn't be helpful in a strategic sense, but would certainly be impressive for the viewer if you saw in the last 6 kilometres what was Nicky Terpstra's average heart rate in that period.
Yeah, we do see this sort of sporadically. The Tour of Portugal did that last year. They had real-time heart rate data, I think, for every rider, or for certainly a lot of the riders. We've seen it before. We've seen SRM data, power output data for 2 or 3 riders who have agreed to it beforehand. But yeah, I think Tour of Portugal did a fairly sort of broad experiment with that last year.
The biggest issue, of course, though, is rider identification. It's hard for the professional commentators. It's even harder for the casual viewer who wants to sit down and watch a Tour de France stage or one of the classics. If you don't know who's on the screen, you're not going to engage with the race. And I think that's the first big step, is to make the riders obvious who they are from a distance. So you can see when there's a group of 8 riders, you can see their name either written large enough on the jersey to be able to see or displayed prominently on the helmet. If you can actually tell immediately who riders are, so that, you know, when somebody's attacking out of the group, you know, everybody knows who that is, and rather than having this kind of delay where you're waiting for the commentator to identify who it is or get a glimpse of the number on the frame or on the back of the jersey. And that would be dead simple to improve immediately, you know, pretty much from now, if you just said, right, every rider must have their name prominently on both sides of their helmet. Obviously there are issues with, you know, the amount of space taken up by sponsorship logos, but I would have thought that the sponsors are getting less good value if the public aren't engaged with the sport.
This is the Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Free.
The other big talking point of the week, really, is Dave Brailsford's decision to step down as performance director from British Cycling. And we've got a question on Twitter from Ken Baldwin asking, will running Team Sky on its own be enough for Brailsford? He made a big point about being able to control his riders' race programmes to ensure they were best prepared for track events. Will he really be stepping back? Daniel?
Yeah, I think so, and I think he probably has stepped back. I think he's found himself spread quite thinly for a while, and I think there are things at Sky that he feels need his full attention. You know, I'm not just talking about controversies like the Henao case. I'm just about the kind of breadth of their race programme and the different disciplines in which they want to have success. And, you know, thus far they've been incredibly successful in the Tour de France and races leading up to the Tour de France, stage races, with their main Tour de France rider. But, you know, they've not been successful in the Giro particularly. They've not won the Vuelta. They've not won a major classic. So I think those are all things that certainly motivate him. And I think that the repetition of the Olympic cycle has probably got a little bit monotonous for Dave Brailsford.
Yeah, I would say, I asked him this question at Paris-Nice a few weeks ago, and we played the interview on the podcast, and, you know, he didn't really answer the question. But the hint was, if you listen between the lines, the hint was that he was going to step back from British Cycling. And I think people are wondering why it's happened now, and I think the reason it's happened now is they've had their review after the Cali Track World Championships, which were in February, where they go through and they analyse, you know, every aspect of performance and coaching. And I think Brailsford has realised that now is the least damaging time to step down. There's still time for British Cycling to either appoint a new performance director or move their coaches around. I mean, they've already appointed Shane Sutton as a technical director, so he will kind of have, I guess, an overseeing role in the interim period before they appoint a performance director. But it gives the new person a fair run-up to Rio in 2016 to get their feet under the table and learn that role and have some kind of effect. I mean, remember, Brailsford took that job on in 2004 with only 7 or 8 months to go before the Athens Olympics, after Peter Keane joined UK Sport. So, you know, it's arguably, although the performance in the 2 track world championships this year in Cali, last year in Minsk, certainly on the men's side have not been great, on the women's side have been terrific performances, the medals continue to come, but certainly leaves British Cycling in a far stronger position than the one he inherited 10 years ago. And I think looking ahead at Rio, is Dave Brailsford going to oversee another haul of 8 gold medals like he had in London and like he had in Beijing? And the answer is probably not. The other nations have caught up. There isn't perhaps the same drive and emphasis on the men's endurance side. They can't necessarily rely on calling Bradley Wiggins or Geraint Thomas back for the team pursuit, so there's a big job to be done to recreate a team pursuit squad there. And I think, as you say, Daniel, you know, Team Sky is such a big operation now, offering, you know, Dave Brailsford a big salary, and you know he's needed on the ground there. You know, he you can see the effect he has on the whole team when he turns up. You know, I noticed it at Paris-Nice, where he's around for the first 3 or 4 days. And I'm not saying that people kind of, you know, relax and think, oh, thank goodness the boss has gone. But when he is there, there is an extra kind of, you know, an extra emphasis to everything that the Team Sky staff and riders do. They know that the boss is around, and I think probably he's realised that he needs to be around, particularly going forward through towards the Tour de France. Speaking of which, Welsh Gramps asks, is Wiggins good enough to win the Tour this year, and is Richie Porte fit enough to race? Daniel, any ideas?
No, Wiggins is not fit enough to win the Tour, and I don't think he will try. I think he looks like he might ride, but I don't think he'll contend on his own, certainly. And I think Richie Porte will be fine for the Tour. He's got plenty of time. It's not a serious problem that he has at the moment. So I think, yeah, he'll be there, and he'll be a very important cog in that wheel.
Now, Alberto Contador won the Tour of the Basque Country last week. Chris Froome's not been in, you know, he's not had the same level of results that he had last year. There might be a few glances at Saxo Tinkoff and at Contador's form in particular, and a realisation at Sky that they've got much more of a race on their hands this year.
Yeah, it certainly looks that way, and Saxo Bank have also got strength in numbers. You know, they've got Kreuziger, who's going well this year. They've got Nicholas Roach, and they've got a very strong unit. Sky have had probably their most difficult spring for the stage races since 2011. But, you know, at this stage, they've still got plenty of time.
And another question from Joe Hill on Twitter. Amiga Pharma look hugely strong so far, but how do you rate them for the Grand Tours? Will they be chasing stage wins, or will they be going for the GC with Rigoberto Urán or Mikhail Kwiatkowski? Kwiatkowski, of course, second to Contador in the Tour of the Basque Country last week.
I think Kwiatkowski obviously missed the white jersey last year at the Tour with Quintana winning. I think it's there for the taking this year, because Quintana, in theory, is not going to do the Tour. I don't think Kwiatkowski was particularly well suited to the role that he had in Cavendish's lead-out train. I know he did lend a hand, but I thought he was nervous, and he would be better served staying out of that train this year. I don't know if Cavendish feels the same way. So he can finish in the top 10 in the Tour, I think. And Urán at the Giro, I don't think he'll win it, but I think he should probably finish in the top 5.
Well, with Daniel's record for winning money on bike races, or predicting winners and then not placing a bet, perhaps get down the bookies. Not that anyone gets down the bookies these days, do they? It's all done online.
I certainly do.
Do you?
Every Friday. All Friday.
Right. Well, that's just about it for this week's episode of the Cycling Podcast. Next week, I'm off to Flesh Wallonne. I'll be doing a special episode from there, and Richard Moore will be back at some point in the next week or so, I think. Maybe he's definitely back within the next 2 to 3 months.
We've missed him so much.
We have indeed. Well, thank you very much for listening, and we will catch you again next time. Daniel, thank you very much.
Thanks, Lionel.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment, or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.